Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, a warm welcome back to the Ross Lair podcast. Today we listen into MEPs Claire Daly and Mick Wallace discussing the Ecuador report.
Here alone, home alone, without Damien again, we decided to pull a fast one and sneak in his absence.
That's not true. He refused to come. He obviously has better things to do.
Too busy, bigger allegedly.
Bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, exactly,
He's probably engaging with nicer people.
Indeed. But in deference to him, we decided to just concentrate solely on our recent visit to Ecuador. Now, that might sound a bit strange, seeing as we've just done a special podcast on Iraq, and we're very conscious of the fact that so many people in Ireland in particular are in a really excruciating lockdown. But for us, it's an example of how safe travel is possible with the right precautions. The world is functioning. We had to go in order to observe the second round of the Ecuadorian elections, which we'd been invited to oversee. There was a lot at stake, so we felt that it was necessary for us to meet that challenge. So, kick off, what was your first impression on it when we got there? Obviously, we're only just back, so we're trying to distill a lot of the information, but...
Well, first of all, if anyone thinks it was a holiday, I can assure you that it was far from it. It takes the best part of a day to get there. It takes the best part of a day to get back. We have COVID tests on either end of it. Two, actually, when we come back. And one before we came back, one before we went. So it's actually four COVID tests for the trip in total. We had five very important meetings there, which were very interesting. And on the day of the election itself, we were out for over 13 hours going to different polling stations and then going to observe the counting in the evening. It was a pretty mad day. And I suppose we need to give a background to the candidates and kind of explain what they stand for, what they don't stand for, how the first round went 2 months ago and how this round went. So there's a lot involved, and we shouldn't be presumptuous and take things for granted as to what people know or don't know. So we better go back to the start with the first campaign, I think. The first in most elections in South America, they have two rounds. And the first and second go into the second round in most countries. And it's an unusual system. Is it good? Is it better than ours? It's debatable. We don't really know yet. It merits research, all right. Just before I go off the subject of COVID, though, I have to say, do you know what? I didn't see one person in the whole of Ecuador in 4 days that we were there not wearing a mask. I never seen such compliance anywhere.
Well, I think,
we've been to a few places.
I think that is important to say, and not just wearing them, but wearing them covering your nose and your mouth. Even the fellas selling cigarettes on the street will spray the packet of cigarettes with sanitizer before they sell it to you. If they give you a pen, they'll spray it with sanitizer. Taxi drivers, everything. The COVID public health sanitation levels are incredibly high, the likes of which we haven't seen anywhere else.
I paid for a coffee on Tuesday morning, and she sprayed the note. I gave her a $5 note, because the currency is actually in dollars, which is actually linked to the candidate that won the election, because the country went broke in 1999, and Lasso was the person responsible for it, and he actually won the election this weekend, unfortunately. But anyway, we'll get to that. But I paid $5, and the girl at the cash desk, she sprayed it both sides and sprayed the note that she gave me back.
And I think one of the reasons for that is probably that Ecuador was one of the hardest hit in the world this around this time last year. There were the horrific pictures of bodies literally lined up on the streets because the hospitals couldn't deal with it, and neither could the morgues or the system. So they've corrected a lot of it since then, brought in a lot of measures, but it was at a very heavy price.
That was directly linked to the fact as well, though, that their health system had been decimated in the last couple of years with right-wing policies after they got rid of Correa. But that's another long story.
Yeah, but I mean, this, I suppose the summary is it's an important country in South America. It's considered a middle-income country, a country of about 18 million people. And as Mick was saying there, we need to look at the first round of elections. So in the first round of elections, the candidate Andreas Arauz, who came from the party of Rafael Correa, who would be seen as the kind of the left wing party, had received about 32% of the vote, with the opposing candidates Lasso, who was the right wing big banker candidate, and a candidate Yaku Perez, who was deemed and lauded in the West as an indigenous leader and actually isn't really. We'll talk about him maybe in a little bit. But both of them nearly got the same percentage of votes. Actually, there was a problem electorally in that the Electoral Council at various stages announced the two of them as the runner-up. And that would cause a huge problem because you have to be the second candidate to get into the second round. And there was a bit of dispute around that. So the whole examination of the functioning of the electoral position was under public scrutiny. But in any case, it was deemed that Lasso had pipped Yaku Perez into second place, and he was the one to contest the final round. And the elections were held on Sunday, the 11th of April there. I suppose the left-wing candidate Arauz went into it with a head start. The opinion polls for the intervening period would have generally shown him being in the lead. We had a meeting with his team the day before the election, and they were probably quite confident. We felt that they were, while the outcome was going to be tight, that they were going to win the election. They were very concerned about maybe some irregularities, particularly around the use of the media and the use of private opinion polls to create an impression that there was a groundswell for Lasso, and then, you know, laying the basis for a kind of a claim of fraud later on. Now, that didn't come to pass. In actual fact, Lasso won quite comfortably. He won the election with 53% up against 47% for Arauz, with a very significant story being the 16% spoiled votes and the fact that 17% of people stayed away. So with the result that we have 33% of the Ecuadorian people didn't vote for either candidate. So it's a pretty divided scenario, even though it was a comfortable victory. And we'd have to say the election was fairly run. So what do you think, Mick, in terms of like what happened and why maybe the left-wing group miscalculated, but also maybe we need to deal with how the election was run, because we were over to observe it. And I suppose the good part of the story is the election was very fair and transparent and well run.
Yeah, I mean, I've observed the elections in Bolivia, Venezuela and now Ecuador in the last 2 years. And the system is pretty similar in all three countries. And I found the system really good, fair and transparent in all three countries. There's actually such a good system. A person comes in to the polling booth and they produce their identity card. And this person sitting at the first table, table number one, reads out, says, OK, you're on the list and your number is this. So the others take down the number. Then the person goes to the second table, picks up the ballot paper and goes behind a screen where they can vote in private. They then put the sheet into a box. Then they go over to table number three and they sign a form with their identity number and the number they were given before they picked up the ballot paper. And then they move to table four, where in actual fact, on the table four, there's a person with a book with a picture of every ID card of everyone that's eligible to vote in that room. And it's generally about 350 per room. And the fact that it has all broken down into small sections, like, for example, we went into one school where there was actually over 80 different rooms, but the maximum number that was allowed to vote in any of the rooms was 350. So the picture of your ID card then was torn out of this book. And you signed the same book, a sheet behind it, and you brought it away with you. Obviously, so it stops anyone from, not only does it stop anyone from voting twice, but also because it's obligatory to vote in nearly all South American countries, and obviously in Ecuador as well, you literally, it costs you money not to vote. And in Ecuador, it's $40. So you can't avail of any state services without having your identity card renewed each year. And if there's been an election and you haven't voted in it, they won't give you a new identity card without you parting with $40 if you fail to vote on the day. Now, if you're over 65, you have a health cert, a medical cert from a doctor or a hospital, to the effect that you couldn't travel, then you get an exemption. But so anyway, normally nearly everybody that can votes, because $40 is a lot of money in a country like this. But as Claire pointed out at the start, on this occasion, something like, was it 17%
stayed away,
which was probably the biggest figure ever for them. Now, as to why 16% spoiled their votes, which was is probably never happened before either, actually it goes back to the day of the first election 2 months ago, when there was three main candidates. There was Lasso, the far right wing fella, and then you have Arruz, who was the left wing guy from the Correa movement, and then you had this Yaku Perez, who stood for the indigenous community, but he presented himself as an environmentalist. Now, anyone that thought, he was presented in Europe as well as a progressive force, but he actually supported the military coup in Bolivia. He has been, he has supported Guaido in Venezuela, and it turned out that he actually got his finance to run the election from the Americans. So that would raise red flags for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, no, and I mean, I think we should tease this out a bit more about what's going on in the indigenous community, and has the left party lost its base there, or what has it made mistakes? What does it need to do there? But just first, before we go on to that, I mean, just finishing off the point on how the election was conducted. I mean, it is incredibly fair. And if you look at the, I suppose, the delays that often take place in counts in Ireland, and that the beauty of this system is that in every single room where the ballots take place, the ballots are opened there in the presence of representatives of all of the parties, and us, the international observers, were divided out, where the 350 people who voted in that box, they first of all count how many ballots haven't been used, they match that then with the numbers that should have voted, and they cross-reference those, and then they divide them out between who voted for what candidate. The score is put up on the wall and everybody can see it. They sign off on the sheet. That sheet is then, each of the sheets from each of the rooms in that area is then scanned into the national voting headquarters, which means that you had the result really very early on, but you also have a very broken down record of the voting in each area, so any discrepancies later on can be re-examined. I think it's a brilliant model and something that we should look at in Ireland, including compulsory voting, which we think is pretty good as well.
Yeah, and a thing that I thought was great as well. I mean, it was so transparent. I mean, we were in the rooms and we were all in different rooms, right? And watching what happened. And it was just so transparent and everything was so accountable. And if, for example, you might say, well, okay, that's grand. Everything is good as long as you can see. But then if it goes back to the headquarters, maybe that's where the shenanigans could start. But in actual fact, every single voting paper is kept. They're all filed by room. So there's not a maximum of 350 in any bag. It's unbelievable. So everything is traceable. So that if, for example, there was fraud suspected, it would be easy to recount, to bring in an independent body and to just count everything again. But as Claire said, I mean, the result, I mean, you have an idea of how long it takes for the things to be counted at home. The election stopped at 5 o'clock. Now, voting stopped. It started at 7 a.m. and it ended at 5 in the afternoon, in the evening. And by 8 o'clock, we had the result. And I mean, if this is a paper vote. It wasn't an electronic vote. It's a paper vote. And they had the result within 3 hours in a, with a population of around 17 million. I mean, it's incredible.
And it's brilliant as well. Like, there was about 39,000 polling stations, and like the left party in that had been saying that they had activists to cover about 30,000 of them. So you're talking about huge, I suppose, grassroots party activism in trying to cover all these polling stations. But each of those party reps can observe the opening of each box if they had everybody in each station, and they get a copy of the vote in paper. Like, I have the one from my station of the one. So each party, they could add them up. So it's foolproof. There can't be any tampering later on.
Not only that, but the member from each of the party for each candidate actually signs that they're actually okay with how the count was done and that the count is accurate. Because you can actually count. I counted every single vote in the room I was in. It actually turned out there was 299 eligible to vote in the room that I was in for the count. 53 didn't turn up. And as it turned out, there was about, I'd say, 47 or 8 of them were oldish people, so they wouldn't actually be fined. But there was a phenomenal amount of spoiled votes, and these were linked to Yaku Perez. So just to go back to that.
We're getting started on that. The last thing I was going to say about the fair elections that we were struck on, because we talked about it, was the role of the police and the army. Now, like many Latin and South American countries, actually the army has a very high standing amongst the population, and this was no exception. We saw the actions of the army who guarded the polling stations, but they were really helpful, and the police as well. Like, it was a bit slow to start in some of the areas. They'd help the electoral workers there. They were helping shepherd people in and out, keeping the queues going, because at some stages in the morning, really by about 8 o'clock in the morning, there was about hundreds of people assembling in various polling stations. So I think that's an important point to make as well, that they did play a good and open role in that, you know.
Yeah, and they were very helpful with any older people that needed assistance. There were anyone that was disabled was helped. And of course, obviously, you're going to talk about the issue about the disabled maybe voting, but there was a special section for it, and there was just a little anomaly about how the vote was moved from the disabled section to the back into the room. But in fairness, given that the army were actually doing the transfer, and
they were really good, and the police.
What really
as well
struck me about the army and police was on the day, anyway, I don't know what they're like normally, but it was really an element of service rather than playing the role of authority, which we're kind of used to, especially with police. And too often draconian. But it was the army were incredibly facilitating and kind and just really friendly and very helpful.
So I suppose the big question for us is, given that we've said it's a fair election, how can we explain the fact that in a country where certain numbers of people told us maybe 50% of the population are in poverty, how could they elect with a strong margin a vicious right wing, as you say, former banker who ruined the economy, and not only elect him, but elect him with a certain amount of a campaign behind him that this is heralding something fresh and new for Ecuador? How could that be, and what do we think is happening there? We can do our own versions of what we think.
Well, look, I mean, to be honest, we've a good bit to learn about it still, but we obviously learned a lot while we were there.
Yeah.
But Lasso was actually running the country in 1999 when the country went broke, and they had to abandon their own currency, and the US dollar became the national currency, and that was all down to Lasso's policies at the time. Now, this guy will be neoliberal, he'll be far right wing, he will not serve the interests of the poor, he will promote US investment interest in the country, and he will favour the rich at the expense of the people who most need their help. But in actual fact, I mean, you'd say then, how in God's name did it happen? Well, the media played a massive role by all accounts. And first of all, Lasso had deep pockets. He was able to spend millions and millions on an election campaign. And he had the full support of the mainstream media. I mean, Lucas, I mean, the mainstream media tend to back up the established parties, no matter where you are, really, because mainstream media are kind of are generally controlled by either by the state or by money people. So like, for example, in Ireland, there's little doubt, but RTE protect Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil morning, noon and night, and they tolerate the likes of the Greens. In Ecuador, by all accounts, the media done a real good job on Arauz, the left-wing candidate. There was a television debate which turned out to be seemingly very significant, and from what we've heard, the debate was kind of 50-50. It was a kind of a slanging match a bit, and but no one really won it. But the media made out that that Lasso had won it 100%, and they sold that story to the people very much in the last couple of weeks. And another thing that was used very much against Arauz and in favour of Lasso was, do you want to be like Venezuela? Do you want Ecuador to turn into a Venezuela? Because Venezuela has huge problems, but they obviously weren't explaining the fact that Venezuela has huge problems because of US sanctions, which unfortunately the EU also supports, and they've decimated the country with the sanctions. It isn't Maduro that's decimating Venezuela, it's the US and sadly Europe. But obviously the media used this as a stick against the Arauz and in favour of Lasso.
I mean, I think you're totally right in that we probably have more questions than answers at this stage after the visit. And I mean, you're also undoubtedly right that Lasso is going to unleash vicious neoliberal economic policies which are not going to benefit the Ecuadorian people. And actually, he revealed, and one of the first things he did was to recognise Juan Guaido, the unelected gobshite, as Mick calls him, in Venezuela, signalling, if you like, that what side of the block in South America he's going to be. So he's not going to align himself, obviously, with the progressive forces, but is going to be a puppet of the US. But we have to see it in the context of what's the government that's there. And it's the hated Lenin Moreno, who had been the deputy of Rafael Correa in the left wing, the previous left-wing government in Ecuador. People will remember that at that time, Correa and his government were the ones who gave sanctuary to Julian Assange in the embassy and played a hugely important international role and had made some efforts and they've made a lot of efforts, but with some degree, varying degrees of success in terms of addressing some of the inequality in that society. But interestingly, Correa and his legacy was a huge part of this issue as well. And we spoke to different people about it. So some people told us that the maintaining the link with Correa had been the reason why Andreas Arauz had done so well and had got the 32% in the first round, and that the party changed tack in the second round and watered down the association with Correa, whereas other people said it was the association with Correa that had been damaging to Arauz and that they needed to develop a different identity coming from the party. So there's quite a lot of division there around those issues.
Yeah, and now while Correa was very popular when he was there and won a couple of elections made great strides in tackling inequality in the country, at the same time, I think the fact that they organised a sort of a coup against him through lawfare, through the judicial system, charges were brought against Correa back in 2017. And he was literally kind of run out of the country. And there was something like 40 court cases that went on, and they were heavily publicised just to damage the people's movement. And Correa is actually exiled in Brussels right now. And if he goes back to Ecuador, he'll be arrested. But Correa, obviously, and I mean, we met him a couple of times here in Brussels, but he claims that the charges were fabricated against him. Now, we don't know the details of it. We do need to learn more about it. But what I was struck by, though, was that we met people of all persuasions, of all different classes, some of them who love Correa and some of them who hate him. I mean, it was a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And we had two very good meetings after the election on Monday and Tuesday with two different members of the Indigenous community. Now, all the Indigenous people would have voted for Yaku Pérez in the first ballot, which was just under 20%. It was 19.3%.
Well, okay,
most of them did anyway, right? But so the Indigenous community are a big vote. But when we met the two different members of the Indigenous community, one of them was in Parliament, and the other one was even a more powerful figure. He was the head of one of the main organisations. But we got a different story from both of them as to who Correa was. And one of them adored him, and the other guy said that when Correa was in power, he distanced himself from a lot of the Indigenous people by different actions that he took, which they disagreed with. And some of the Indigenous people claimed that Correa didn't treat them well and didn't look after their interests, whereas the other guy claimed otherwise. So
yeah,
it's hard to know where the truth lies.
And there is a thing, I mean, the points you were making about lawfare and the legal action against Correa, and people should remember that the same thing was done with Lula in Brazil, the leader of the Workers' Party, who was imprisoned and prevented from running, given basically then the presidency to Bolsonaro. But he has been absolutely, not to mind what did he spend a load of time in prison, but he's been absolutely vindicated now that that was completely trumped up. And it's absolutely the case that there is huge political persecution in Ecuador, with hundreds of activists being under political prosecution, if you like, and persecution. I mean, we met with the governor of an area, a very good woman who'd been elected to represent her community in an area of Quito, and an Indigenous leader. And then we noticed that the two of them had electronic tags on their legs because they'd been released from prison only in the last number of months. They'd been arrested, so-called, for rebellion, and their cases were pending, and many, many cases are pending. So this is a tactic by the vicious Ecuadorian state to undermine activists and those trying to represent the interests of ordinary people. There's a lot of Indigenous people awaiting prosecution as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, her crime was that she was really active in the people's movement. And she, I mean, you should see this huge big steel brace on her ankle, about 4 inches tall. And it's on, she can't move it off. It has to stay there morning, noon and night. And she has to carry it around everywhere. I mean, it's just madness.
This is the elected mayor of a city.
So one of the big questions now is whether the persecutions will stop or will they continue? Will there be will Lasso, you know, take a different tact than Lenin Moreno? Because Lenin Moreno, the persecutions were dramatic under him, and so many people were being imprisoned and totally without foundation, a lot of it.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that the programme that Lasso ran the election on was very much not of brutal, naked neoliberal capitalism. He actually tried to present himself as a modern leader of a modern Ecuador that could be part of the first world. So his huge amount of propaganda was loads of videos with young people, with Indigenous people, with the feminist movement, with the LGBT community, and was all about building. So it all sounded like really nice stuff, presented really cute and colourful, with huge big PR companies behind him. He also had in the debate, he'd had this mantra that they'd obviously polished, "Stop lying, Andreas, stop lying, Andreas," and this became a hashtag, and they were doing this big hashtag campaigns. But that said, we did see a lot of Ecuadorian young people who were active in Lasso's campaign. We saw them in the polling stations, and it'll be interesting to see, because these people bought the lie that he represents a new Ecuador, not actually the brutal face of neoliberal Ecuador. So how he packages that and what he does is interesting. But we need to go back to the indigenous community, because it is true that there's divisions there. I wouldn't say all the indigenous community voted for Yaku Pérez. I mean, actually, both sides of the people we met made the point that Yaku Pérez is a relatively new figure on the indigenous scene, as it were, that there are deep-rooted social organisations representing the indigenous community, and Yaku Pérez is not from that sector. He is a member of Pachacuti, which is the political party representing the indigenous community. But there's a feeling on all sides that he has manoeuvred himself, if you like, or the sort of right wing have manoeuvred into a certain position inside that organisation, which is probably true. But the other side is that the left wing have probably not done enough on environmental issues. And as you said, Mick, have been not attentive enough to indigenous issues either. Like, they made the points that more mining was carried out under Correa.
And he increased it. Yeah. And listen, there's a big debate to be had. When you have a poor country like that, it's all very well for us in Europe to say, you shouldn't be doing anything that's environmentally unfriendly. But in actual fact, the countries from the global south are not the ones who have caused the environmental damage. It's the north, the developed north is where all the environmental damage has been done. And now, obviously, there's if the mining that Korea was sanctioning, if it was being done to improve the health and education and housing provision and whatever for the general population of Ecuador, well, you would say you could make an argument for it, provided that that's where the money was going. But if it was foreign nationals like the Canadians and Americans coming in, or the Chinese or the Russians or whoever, but it's mostly Canadians and Americans down there, if they're the ones actually benefiting from it, and that there's only a token benefit for the state, then obviously it's completely wrong. But I mean, listen, most mining at this stage is damaging to the people's health, the health of the environment, and a lot of it needs to be stopped.
Yeah, and I mean, you are right to make that point, because I think I would have no hesitation in saying that I think Correa most definitely tried, and the record of Correa's government showed attempts to reduce the inequality and so on. That doesn't mean to say that they may have made mistakes or whatever, but they were also the victims of brute repression. And I can't remember the story that you told Andrea Arauz the night before the election about what needed to be done, your football story. But I think after the election result, it was even more relevant for them going forward. So will you remind me what it was? Because I can't remember now.
I will, yeah. I asked him if he was interested in football. So he said he was, right? But so
yeah, I didn't get the impression. I wasn't convinced either.
But anyway, I was just saying that the fact that it's a people's movement, he's working for the poorer sections of society, he's trying to tackle inequality. It does mean that he won't have the support of the media. He won't have the support of big business. He won't have the support of the Americans or the EU. So it's a big challenge, and you're up against it. And no matter how good your story is, no matter how good a leader that you're capable of being, you're actually fighting against mighty powerful forces who have great potential to undermine your chances of getting elected. And one of the reasons that Yaku Pérez got elected was that he had access to an awful lot of funding, and seemingly a lot of it came from what's called the National Endowment for Democracy. Now, the National Endowment for Democracy, it's often called NED. It's like it's a regime change arm of the American state. It's really a wing of the CIA of the Americans, and it's designed to help organizations who challenge the left wing and who promote right wing policies and promote American interest in the region. And I mean, we actually have them in Europe as well, and they're called the European Endowment for Democracy. And the European Endowment for Democracy are promoting protests, are financing some of the protest movements in Belarus at the moment. While we're not fans of Lukashenko, we don't approve of Western interference, and because that's what it is now. And they're only interested in Belarus because it's on the Russian border. But that's what the European Endowment for Democracy does. It's a wing of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the American version, and they operate all over the world. They gave huge support to Yaku Perez. And obviously, you'll find that they would have been very much on the side of Lasso against Arus. They went to great lengths to make sure that Arus wouldn't become the president of Ecuador. And the night we were with Arus before the election, I told him that his position, for someone from the left running against mighty forces like Lasso or against the money that Yaku Perez was given, I said, it's always challenging. I said, and the same challenge actually exists in Europe. But I said, it's a bit like in football parlance, I said, it's like a small club playing against the big club that wins most of the things all the time, the club with the money. It's always difficult to actually beat them, and you have to be a good bit better than them to actually end up winning. They get the breaks. The referees are actually very often afraid to go against them, and it's, you just have to be that bit better if you're going to get a clean win. And I said that, I said to Arus, you're going to need an extra bit of support from the people to actually become the clear winner, because if it's any way close, I said, you may struggle to be declared the winner.
I just thought, well, I mean, the next day after the result, I thought that was even more relevant because, you know, they're good people. He seems like a really nice guy who's trying. He's a young economist. The people around him have, you know, great hopes for the future. But they're going to have to go now and rebuild the movement and be better than the ones who are there. And that's the task posed in front of them. And we were obviously disappointed by the election results. We can only imagine how bad they feel, but there's no way around it other than going back to the grassroots and rebuilding up that support and being ready for the next time. So we obviously wish them all the best in that, and we'll do what we can here to champion their cause.
I think it's significant as well that I would say on the election last Sunday, I think a lot of the young people from various backgrounds actually voted for Lasso. He probably managed maybe to come across as the more progressive, even though this guy is over 70 years of age and he has not only far right wing political philosophy in his war chest up to this date, and the idea that he's going to be progressive now is probably nonsense. But he sold that story well through the media, and a lot of the young people believed it and went out and voted for him. And I mean, it's crazy to think of poor people and poor young people actually going out and voting for Lasso, who will not serve their interest. I mean, it's scary stuff, really.
Mm. But yeah, I think it's how he implements that program and how they react is the way forward. So look, we wish them all the best. We'll continue. The EU is supposedly the biggest donor or contributor in Ecuador and has a lot of important links there. So we'll be very much keeping an eye on this country going forward. So we will await for Damien's happy return next time, where we will next time most definitely go back to our tour of European countries, where we have France outstanding at the moment. So as they say in Ecuador, adios.
Good luck.
Hi, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Claire Daly and Mick Wallace for permission to use this material. keep on listening to TRP.